The third case on today's oral argument calendar is number A18-1281, State of Minnesota versus Troy Wearson. Counsel are familiar with our rules and our allotment of time. You may approach and begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent Troy Wearson. Because the state has conceded that the evidence was insufficient regarding the sale and the conspiracy convictions, I would like to focus my argument this morning regarding issue one on the possession along with the child endangerment convictions, but I'm, of course, able to answer questions if the court has any regarding the sale and conspiracy. While the state's evidence certainly established an inference that Mr. Wearson constructively possessed the methamphetamine found in the garage merely because he had resided at that home at some point and there was a driving citation on top of the toolbox, the circumstance proved in this case certainly do not disprove the reasonable inference that it was his wife's methamphetamine and that he was not exercising dominion and control over the methamphetamine at the time that law enforcement found it during their search. And this is true for two reasons. First, the circumstances proved related to his wife established that she was at the residence. She had an insurance card inside the toolbox. They found a scale in a drawer in her bedroom. And of course, she was arrested. Those circumstances established that there's a reasonable inference that that methamphetamine was hers and was for her personal use only.
Wasn't the bedroom also his if he had been there?
There is no testimony that that was his bedroom at that time. The officer referred to the bedroom as her bedroom only, and the state did not present any evidence that he had clothing in the bedroom or any personal effects inside the bedroom.
You would agree that this is a constructive possession case, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And there can be constructive possession by more than one person.
Correct.
So while the circumstances that you just listed support the inference that she may have been in possession, they don't exclude the inference that he was also in possession.
We are in agreement that there is an inference that he was in possession, but the circumstantial evidence test requires this court to determine whether there are any other reasonable inferences, and all of those circumstances also establish that there's a reasonable inference that it was just her methamphetamine.
But those circumstances alone don't establish that it was just her methamphetamine, I don't think, especially when you look at the rest of the circumstances proved. In particular, his statement to the police after the police called him while they were executing the search warrant and told him that the police identified himself as being with the Dakota County Drug Task Force, told him that they were at his home serving the search warrant for drugs, and asked him to come to the residence to speak to him. And he responded that, "I'm not coming home." And the drugs were found in a toolbox that had a citation on, there was evidence of a citation issued to him in that same toolbox. A male's watch was found on the toolbox, and after he's asked by the police to come to the house during the execution of the search warrant, he says he's not coming home. How is that statement consistent with a rational inference that the drugs only belong to his wife?
A few responses. First, you have to look at that statement in context. They called him and said, "Will you come to the house so we can speak with you?" And he responded, "I'm not coming home." There is a reasonable inference that he was not residing at the residence at that time, that he was not any...
But I'm not sure there is a reasonable inference in that regard. I mean, when you look at the totality of the circumstances proved, there's also circumstance proved that there's a picture of his wife and him and two children on the wall of the living room. The citation was relatively recent, within a week or 10 days, I believe, maybe slightly longer. There's pictures of him and a child on the toolbox. And so there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that suggests that he is still residing at the home.
And we will concede that there is an inference that he was residing at the home and that he constructively possessed the methamphetamine. But the way we have to look at that is then the next step is, are all of those circumstances, do they disprove a reasonable inference that he did not exercise dominion and control over the methamphetamine at that time? I think it's also important, in addition to just the facts related to his wife, under this court's recent case in Herman, we also look at uncontroverted facts in the record. And what's uncontroverted? It's that law enforcement didn't conduct any surveillance of the residence. They had no idea whether he had ever been at the house besides the facts that you just listed.
But
they
those
did not
are
do
all negative activities. And in Herman, this court ruled that the court said this argument presents us with the question of whether the absence of evidence constitutes a circumstance proved. We answer in the negative. So I don't think just because the police didn't view him in possession of the drugs that that proves anything. It doesn't, I mean, to establish possession, constructive possession, the police don't have to establish that they observed him with the drugs.
That's correct. And I think what's important to take away from Herman is that if the evidence was presented and the officer says no, then that is a circumstance proved. In Herman, I know you're on the panel.
But we also said that the evidence has to relate to the alleged crime. And so just because the officer says, no, I didn't observe this, that doesn't mean that it is a circumstance proved regarding the alleged crime. Because you can prove constructive possession without the officer observing the individual possessing the drugs.
Yeah, I'm not saying that because the law enforcement didn't surveil the residence, that therefore the circumstance proved is that he wasn't at the residence. The circumstance proved is that the officers did not surveil the house, that they had no surveillance of it. That's not saying that the circumstance proved is that he wasn't there. That's the reasonable inference that I am taking that this court has to consider and determine whether the state's evidence negates that. The officers also didn't present any evidence that Mr. Wearson had ever been around a controlled substance, had ever used a controlled substance, had ever sold a controlled substance. There's nothing in the record.
But we don't take from that he did or didn't use a controlled substance. I mean, that doesn't really prove anything one way or another. It just proves they didn't know that, but I'm having a hard time seeing how these. I read your brief carefully, and I looked at the list of items on page 14 of that the officers never observed appellant possessing the meth, didn't observe appellant residing in the house, but I don't think those things prove anything one way or another.
When the state,
because there's a lot of other circumstances proved, and those things you don't have to prove that he was residing there on that day.
No, but when there's a giant void in evidence, and I think it's clear in this case, there wasn't a thorough investigation from what the facts that were presented to the jury. There was one law enforcement officer who testified regarding all of this information. Another officer testified about the phone call, and then there was a BCA agent who testified about the drugs. There wasn't much evidence. And in circumstantial...
Part of that was the marital privilege, though, wasn't it?
Right, but this court doesn't consider that insufficiency of the evidence.
I understand that.
We look at the record.
That's perhaps why the law enforcement people approached it the way they did, because...
Right,
but the information they needed from her, basically.
But law enforcement also has to understand the rules, mm-hmm. and has to understand that there are ways to do investigations if in a case where the rules of evidence don't allow certain evidence to come in. So I don't think this court considers any of the correct pretrial rulings regarding what evidence comes in for a sufficiency standard. When there is a giant void of evidence, when we're talking about circumstantial evidence, that's where all these inferences come from, right? And that's what we can do on appeal, is we can look at what the circumstances proved are, and they're very minimal in this case. There was a toolbox in the garage. He lived there at some point. There was a photograph in the house that showed that he lived there at some point. That's pretty much it. And are there inferences that come from that are reasonable that say that it was just her methamphetamine? Absolutely. It could have been her methamphetamine that she was using. She was the only one there. There's no evidence that he had been there in the last couple weeks. And there's no evidence that he had even acknowledged that there were drugs
in
the house.
Well, but he said, I'm not coming home. Why would he say, I'm not coming home, if he didn't reside there? Why would he tell the police officer on that day, I'm not coming home?
The officer testified that he did not know the marital status of them at that time. So we don't know if he wasn't living at the house, if he was at work, if he was out of town. There's no, you have to read that in context. The state's kind of cherry-picking that statement and saying, well, that establishes some consciousness of guilt or that he knew about the methamphetamine. He said, can you come home so we can talk about what's going on here? If he is not with his wife at that time and doesn't want to deal with her problems with law enforcement or her drug problem, it's reasonable that he's just not coming home right then. It's not saying that that's his drugs or...
You agree that the address on the citation that was recently issued is the same address where the search warrant was issued?
Absolutely.
Executed.
And there's a couple of weeks between that citation and when the search took place. And I think a lot can happen in a couple
weeks.
But they
said he was at his residence. The officer told him that he's at his residence, and he says, I'm not coming home. And you think that short gap is enough to suggest that he lived somewhere else?
Possibly. We don't even know how that
to me seems to be speculation.
Well, even if you want to say that he had been at that house 3 days before, that doesn't establish that he was consciously exercising dominion and control over methamphetamine found in a toolbox. And we have these giant leaps left and right in this case where there is just no connection between him and what's in the toolbox.
You know, a lot of the other cases seem to involve bedrooms and shared dresser drawers and things like that. Is it your position that's what differentiates your case, the fact that it was a separate container in a garage?
I think that definitely supports us. If this methamphetamine was found in a bedroom and law enforcement had presented clothing, male clothing from the bedroom, and it was in a drawer with the methamphetamine, I think we'd have a much different argument.
But isn't it true that there was a picture of him with a child taped to the toolbox?
Yeah, and again, we're not disputing that there's an inference that he lived at that house, and I think it's reasonable for someone else to have a photograph, his wife, of a kid and him on the toolbox. And even if it was his toolbox at some point, that still doesn't mean that he had exercised dominion and control over it at that time. And again, the lack of investigation and the lack of evidence presented created this giant void where these inferences are reasonable. It is reasonable that his wife was using methamphetamine and possessing it, and he had nothing to do with it. And I don't think that phone call on its own negates that inference. I don't think the fact that there are photographs in the house negate that inference. I think it's a very reasonable inference that the state did not disprove. If the court doesn't have any questions regarding those counts, I also just wanted to quickly touch on the child endangerment and that he was also convicted and sentenced of that for that offense. And the state presented absolutely no evidence related to the relationship of Mr. Wearson and this child. There's no testimony that it was his son, no testimony that it was his stepson, no testimony about any sort of child care arrangements or anything.
Child did have a different last name, right?
That's correct.
And is there any evidence that he was a caretaker for the child?
No, there is absolutely nothing. They didn't even try to establish it. The prosecutor in closing argument referred to the child as his stepson, but there was no evidence of that. So I'm not sure how the jury reached that conclusion.
Is there any case law about the definition of caretaker?
I believe the statute.
I mean, the statute
has a definition in there. I can.
Right.
But again, the state didn't even present evidence, and in their brief, there's no argument regarding how he fit under caretaker. The state just said you should affirm that conviction. So I don't know what their position is on that.
And again, the child in the home at the time of the search. Do we know whether it's that child was in any of the photos?
No, they didn't present any evidence that there was a connection between the photographs and the child. There's just no testimony other than that the child was there and it had a different last name, and police believe that it could have been his wife's stepson or related to her somehow. With that, I'd like to also touch on the second issue quickly, if I may. The error here is egregious. There were four questions presented to the trial court. Sessions makes it very clear what the court has to do in that situation, and Mr. Wearson had a constitutional right to be in the courtroom and hear those questions read to him. I don't think there's any dispute that there's error. I think the state has actually conceded that. As far as prejudice, if there's a case where the evidence is not strong, because that's the factor this court looks to, it's this case. The state has conceded insufficient evidence on their two top counts, and as we're discussing this morning, the evidence is not strong related to the other two counts.
So if you had been trial counsel, what would you have done upon getting notice and having a conference with the judge?
Yeah, I believe that if we're referring to the substance of the responses right. By the judge, I think the substance of the responses are fine for questions 1, 2, and 4, the questions regarding seeing new evidence, basically seeing a calendar, whether they can consider new evidence. And the judge said, no, you can't, we're not going to present any more evidence. I think that's fine. The problem in this case is the second question regarding whether the jury can consider whether she was arrested or whether she was convicted of the crime. The court never answered that question. And that goes directly to the jury not understanding the court's instructions regarding objections and how they're supposed to consider evidence when there's an objection.
So what would you have asked the district court to do?
Regarding that, you know, I don't think that's the standard, but I would say that the jury should consider the evidence from their own memory and what they believe the evidence was, and then also to look to the instructions regarding how they consider evidence that, where there's been an objection and a ruling on the objection. And that didn't happen here. And if I could just quickly...
What was the evidence on whether she was charged or convicted?
Yeah, the defense, if I may.
Right? Yeah, please do.
The defense attorney asked the police officer if she was arrested, and the police officer said yes. The defense attorney then asked, and she was charged with a drug offense, and there was an objection, and the court sustained the objection. So there was the jury obviously
heard
that.
No evidence that she had been convicted.
No evidence that she had been convicted, but the jury did hear that, and the jury had questions, and I think...
What do you mean? They didn't hear that she was convicted. They heard that she was arrested.
Yeah, but they heard that she was arrested, but then the question obviously included the word charged, mm-hmm. and maybe the jury inferred from that that she was convicted as well. So I think a proper response to that question could have clarified things for the jury. And then the last portion of it said, we will provide you no more information. I think that was definitely a gag order on the jury asking any more questions. I mean, they came back with 4 questions within an hour of deliberating. I think that did not allow them to ask any further questions. And I can respond during rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Counsel for the state.
Good morning, panel, counsel. My name is Heather Pipenhagen. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this case. There was sufficient evidence in the record at this trial to support the jury's verdict on count 1, the possession of methamphetamine. Counsel is correct. I wasn't trial counsel, but I reviewed the record, and I don't believe there was sufficient evidence on count 3 and 4, which involved conspiracy and aiding and abetting another individual. I don't think I have to get into that a whole lot, but I think your honors were able to glean from the record there was a material witness in this case that did not appear. A warrant was issued, and getting close to the end of the trial, that witness still hadn't been apprehended, so that testimony wasn't presented. So the evidence that needed to be presented for counts 3 and 4 was not presented to the jury.
How about count 2, though? What's the evidence there?
The evidence there, I think, and I'll get into the evidence about him being at the residence, residing at the residence, but I think there was evidence that it was his house, that he lived there, that there were children involved in the family. There was a child there when the police executed the warrant, and the location of the drugs had clear accessibility to a child. There was a child's bicycle in the garage, which supports the fact that there's children living in the residence. Was there any other evidence presented on count 2? There wasn't. So I would just rely on the record and the court's decision on that count.
So there's no evidence that he had responsibility for the care of the child?
There was nothing in the record about his role with that child or his relationship to that child. That's
okay,
correct.
Thank you.
But there was sufficient evidence that did get to the jury to support count 1, the simple possession, constructive possession of the methamphetamine in that toolbox. So as we both talked about in our briefs, the first thing this court has to look at is what were the facts proven. Now, there really weren't any disputed facts in this case. So the facts that were proven and presented by the state were the following. The search warrant was based on initially a tip received by the drug task force involving appellant and this residence. The jury heard that evidence. Second, the jury heard that the investigators then pulled some trash from that residence after getting that tip and found drug-related items in the trash.
And can I ask about the tip? I mean, was the tip offered for a limited purpose or for any purpose?
The information, as far as the content of the tip, was limited by the judge. There was an objection from the defense attorney. It sounds like there was a bench conference. She did limit the information that could get to the jury on that. She didn't limit its purpose or how the jury could use it, but she limited what information the jury could hear. But what the jury did hear is that the drug task force got a tip regarding appellant and that Tiffany Drive residence. That led to the beginning of the investigation. That's the extent of the information that the jury heard.
Why wasn't that hearsay?
I don't know what the bench conference was and what the arguments were.
Why couldn't you just go to the fact you had a search warrant and that's why you went? Why would you even introduce that?
I suspect, again, without a record made as to what happened at the bench, I suspect the argument was it's not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. It's offered to show why they started the investigation. But I don't know what the legal arguments were about that. That's what I would argue.
Couldn't they have just said we had a tip? That's why we started.
They could have.
They didn't need to say that the tip.
They could have.
Tipster said that he was dealing or.
Correct. I think some of the implications of that to the jury become pretty similar when you're saying the drug task force got a tip about this residence, which led to them to execute a search warrant. I mean, most people can read between the lines and they know what the nature of that tip was. So the additional information that involved the appellant and the residence was the only thing more specific.
But to the extent that at that time you know you're trying to prove this case against the defendant, by introducing that, you're not introducing it really to explain why the officers acted the way they do. You're introducing it to prove that the tipster said he was the person dealing.
And I can't speak for the intent of the trial attorney to put that evidence in. I mean, at the time, he was taking testimony from the officer about why they started the investigation. And I could also argue that he didn't have that bad intention, that he was simply trying to explain why the cops ended up at the house on this date.
Could he have just said, you know, we got a tip and we did a garbage pull and we found supporting evidence in the garbage pull and got a search warrant.
Could have. And it appeared to me from reading the record that the officer was about to talk more about the substance of the tip, and that's when the objection came. So the trial court properly limited that testimony, and he quickly moved on to what the next steps were. So they didn't get any information other than that. Again, drug-related items found in the trash. The circumstances prove that the appellant's wife was present in the residence when the search warrant was executed, along with this child. On the living room wall, we prove that there was a family picture showing the appellant and his wife and two children. We proved that in the bedroom that Nichelle Wearson was seen coming out of by the officers, there was a dresser, and in that dresser drawer, there were men's items. I believe it was a belt buckle and a watch. And along with those two items also was a digital scale. In the attached garage is the toolbox that contained methamphetamine and numerous other drug-related items throughout that toolbox, as explained by the officer and depicted in the photographs that were offered.
Were there men's clothing in the dresser drawer?
The testimony was a little ambiguous, but it appeared the first picture put in of that citation, the officer said, this is as it was found, and there was a men's watch on top of the citation. So not men's clothing, but a men's watch.
On the toolbox.
Correct.
I think Judge Kirk was asking a different question.
In the bedroom, were there...
I don't know that because there was no evidence presented about that. So if there were other men's items in the bedroom, it was not, it's not in the record. There was no testimony about it, so the jury wouldn't have heard anything about that.
Doesn't seem very thorough.
Well, what evidence was...
If as an officer you're trying to tie somebody to the crime that isn't there, and you've got somebody that's there, don't you want to establish clearly that they're living there, sleeping in the same bed, all those kinds of things? That's what's my understanding of how police worked when I was doing that stuff.
You sure do, and what we are limited to in this case as far as facts is the record, which is the evidence that this prosecutor chose to present. I don't even begin to assume that's all the evidence there was in this case. I'm sure they did a full search warrant of the house. So, I mean, everything that was in the house was documented. Mm-hmm. At some point, the prosecutor chose what evidence to elicit from the officers and to present to the jury. So that's what we're limited to, what the officers documented in the house. Their police reports didn't go into evidence. So I don't want to criticize the officers and say, well, didn't you even look around? Because maybe they did, and the prosecutor didn't present that evidence.
But it seems like once the material witness doesn't show up and they decide to proceed, that it's time to go back to your folks and find out what else can we put in to solidify this case.
And I suspect the reason why there wasn't, again, I'm speaking for somebody else, but there were no drugs found in the bedroom. So I suspect that's why the focus was not what other items were found in the bedroom if there's no drugs in the bedroom. So the focus was on what other items were found in and around the toolbox, which is the proximity of where the drugs were. But I don't know. Also on that toolbox, as mentioned, is there, I believe it was magnet to it or stuck to it or taped to it, but it's attached to the front of the toolbox, was the numerous pictures of appellant with a child, and this very recent citation that was given to the appellant, again with a men's watch, apparently sitting right on top of the citation on the toolbox. And there was also, there was the value of the drugs were proved to the jury. There was testimony that depending on how these drugs would be broken down and sold, the value of the drugs found in the toolbox was at least $1,200, possibly much more if broken down and sold on the street. There was the evidence presented and proved that the officer called appellant and told him they were at his residence executing a search warrant. And asked him to come home, and appellant's response was, I'm not coming home. Appellant's response wasn't, which house? Which house, where are you? So there's no reason to infer that he has more than one residence. The officer just said, I'm at your residence, we're executing a search warrant, and appellant said, I'm not coming home.
So appellant argues that evidence isn't sufficient to demonstrate that he exercised dominion and control given the... There's no evidence that he was residing there in that after the citation was issued in any event. What evidence or what circumstances proved do you believe show that he was exercising dominion and control and that the alternative hypothesis is not a rational alternative hypothesis?
I think that there's an inference that it was his residence and that he was residing there. Now, was there evidence that put him at that toolbox on that date of the search warrant? There wasn't. But there were items that would be important to him, such as a citation that needs to be paid and needs to be dealt with, still sitting on that toolbox, a men's watch. So I think there is a rational inference that he was coming back. He hadn't left, and he hadn't left it there. It was a place that he was residing and therefore was exercising dominion, probably joint dominion and control over that toolbox. If, as argued by the prosecutor in the closing argument, the wife was involved in this. We don't know that because we had no evidence of that. But it could be joint dominion and control, but he was exercising dominion and control. There was no reason to think he had abandoned that toolbox. He still had important items at the toolbox. The final two facts that were proven by the evidence here, or the final fact, is it was, and I think this is kind of important because it shows that the jury did consider her. They did consider Nichelle Wirsen. And we showed, or we proved that she was arrested at the time of the search warrant. There was no evidence presented that she was charged because the officer was asked that question and there was an objection. So there was no answer in the record as to that, and there was certainly no evidence or even a question about whether or not she was convicted. But the jury definitely did hear that she was arrested. So at least on the day of the search warrant, the officers arrested her in connection with the finding of the drugs. So I think the facts that were proven lead to some rational inferences. One, that this was the defendant's residence and his toolbox. And they're also consistent with the inference that he constructively possessed the methamphetamine. Before we go any further, there was a comment made. I'm going to talk a little bit about the law, but there's a comment made about it being a poor investigation, and Justice Kirk asked a question about that too. I think one thing that's clear from the record, because there were some arguments about admissibility of evidence, there was more evidence in this case than what was presented to the jury. So I don't come up here to defend law enforcement.
But we can't speculate about what that is.
In response to the comment that this was a poor investigation, it's clear from the record there were phone records that were obtained, and there was other evidence. It wasn't presented to the jury, so
Your point's well taken that the quality of the investigation is maybe impacted by the choices the trial attorney made at the time, which may have been impacted by the fact that there was some reliance on a material witness who didn't appear.
Correct.
And that might explain why some things were not.
Correct. And, and there's evidence that is subject to legal rulings. And I'm not saying any of the court's rulings suppressing evidence weren't correct, but they're just that there was more evidence. So I always like to defend law enforcement when that comes up.
And just to be clear, there's no evidence in the record of either fingerprints or DNA, correct?
No. Okay. There was no evidence in the record of that. And I think the defense attorney emphasized that throughout the trial and in closing argument. And as far as the other inferences then that support the constructive possession, the fact that appellant just wasn't home at the time the search warrant was executed doesn't change any of the inferences about the evidence that was proven. It doesn't mean that it wasn't his drugs or that he wasn't exercising dominion and control.
Well, what about appellant's argument that these could have just been his wife's drugs and that she could have put them there after he left, I guess is the insinuation.
Left for work that day?
He wasn't there at the time. There isn't evidence about when he was last there.
And I think
I guess the argument could be that they were her drugs, that she put them there at a time that he wasn't exercising dominion and control over the toolbox.
I think in all constructive possession arguments, or in all constructive possession cases, there's an argument that someone else put the drugs there and the defendant didn't know about it. They were planted, they belonged to another co-resident. I think that's speculation. There isn't any evidence supporting that somebody else put those drugs there. And the outside of the wife, the large quantity of drugs and the value of those drugs negate any inference that someone else just left them at the house, or that the people living in the house didn't know they were there. That's not a reasonable inference, particularly in light of the other evidence that was found, the plethora of drug-related evidence found in the toolbox, the digital scale that's upstairs in the dresser drawer. I don't think it's reasonable that you had over 1,000, up to $2,800 worth of drugs in your house and you had no idea. So that could be speculation, but that's in the category of mere conjecture, which these courts have said we're not going to overturn a jury's verdict based on mere conjecture. The evidence before the jury didn't lead to that inference.
I have a question about the phone call between the officer and the defendant appellant when he said, "I'm not coming home." Did the officer say, "I'm at 219 Tiffany Drive"? Or did he somehow identify that particular residence, to him before the defendant used the word home?
If the transcript disputes what I'm about to say, obviously the transcript's a transcript. I don't remember him saying that he cited the address. He said, I believe the way he testified to it was, "I'm at your residence executing a search warrant." Obviously, the only information is what would be in the transcript during the officer's testimony. But I don't recall him stating the address. Does that mean he didn't state the address? I don't know. I just know the way he said it when he testified. And I don't believe that included citing to the address. As noted, counsel submitted the recent case, the Herman case. And I think some of the ideas in that case are important to this situation. In that opinion, the court stated possibilities of innocence do not require reversal if the evidence as a whole makes such theories unreasonable. So I would argue that also applies to this situation here. Also in Herman, the court commented about personal items near the controlled substances and said when the appellant's personal items are near the controlled substance, that is evidence tying the defendant to that substance. And also going to Justice Cochran's last question, as in the Herman case, the court stated in that case, any inference indicating the meth belonged to someone else is wholly speculative and untied to the evidence that was presented to the jury. So you can always speculate, and it's always argued in a constructive possession case that the drugs weren't the defendant's. I mean, that's the hard part of all those cases. But there wasn't any evidence that would support that idea. All of the evidence that was presented supports the reasonable inference that the drugs did belong to the defendant and not to anybody else.
We've gone over your allotted time.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Mr. Erickson.
Just quickly on Herman, the facts are so different in that case. They're in a car. The defendant is in the car with the drugs with the other person that he said that it belonged to him. So I don't think the facts of that case necessarily apply here. It's more for the principles of law. As far as whether or not it was his home or not, we are conceding that at some point he resided at that home. There is going to be some items that belong to him in that home. The citation was there, but there's no evidence of clothing in the bedroom. There's no evidence of anything else. The belt buckle. They didn't say it was a male belt buckle. Women wear belt buckles all the time. I think that's, again, a giant leap. But even if this court decides that he was living at the house at that time, under Sam, it's not just about having control over the place. It's about, do you have dominion and control over the contraband? And on page 147 and 148 of the transcript, the prosecutor is examining the law enforcement and asked, as far as the items found in the garage, is there any indication that the tool chest for those drugs belonged to anyone else? Cop said, aside from the defendant, yes. Yes, and who was that? And he responded, Nichelle Wearson. So the cops believe that it could have been her toolbox. And
well,
that also,
doesn't that suggest it could have been, they could have had joint control of the toolbox?
That's correct. But it also creates the inference that those were her drugs, and there's nothing else connecting him. If we want to conclude that it was that she had something to do with those drugs, what is there that then connects Mr. Wearson to the toolbox and the drugs besides the fact that he had lived there at some point? Again, we're just taking giant leaps regarding his connection with that part of the house and inside the toolbox.
Or it could be their drugs, right?
It could, and again, that's the first prong of the circumstantial evidence test, is that there is a reasonable inference that it was their drugs. But is there also a reasonable inference that it was just hers? Absolutely. And why? Because of law enforcement's investigation. And again, I'm not criticizing the police, but just as far as how it came in at the trial, there was no surveillance, there was no controlled by, there was no eyewitness who said that they ever saw Mr. Wearson with drugs, there was no eyewitness that said they ever saw him sell drugs or was in the garage at any point or was around the toolbox within the last couple weeks. I mean, we get drug cases all the time, and there's always surveillance before they execute a search warrant so they know who is inside of the residence, and then they can connect the dots if they need to, and that just wasn't done in this case. As far as Judge Kirk's questions regarding the anonymous tip, your concerns, that's actually what took place in this case. There wasn't any evidence that was introduced regarding the tip. There was an anonymous tip, objection, they had a bench conference, they came back, there was no other questions. So it wasn't there was an anonymous tip regarding drug activity. So the jury never heard any evidence regarding the investigation prior to the execution of the search warrant or prior to the trash pull.
Yeah, I thought the evidence was that there was a tip that he was selling drugs out of the home.
That's not how it came in.
Okay, so that wasn't...
The jury never heard any evidence that Mr. Wearson had anything to do with drugs. And the officer was also asked, so what do you do as far as the drug task force? And he testified, well, obviously we do drug investigations, but we also do violent offender investigations. So that evidence doesn't establish anything, the fact that there was a tip at this house and then they conducted a trash pull. The items found in the trash pull could have been his wife's, the stuff she uses for using the drugs. That's what they found. They found paraphernalia in the trash can. So that certainly supports our reasonable inference. Again, as far as the digital scale that was found, I think that also supports our reasonable inference because there was no evidence that Mr. Wearson was residing in that bedroom and that's where it was found. It supports the fact that she was the one who was using these drugs, who was using the scale to measure the weight of these drugs. And again, there's nothing that connects him to that bedroom. If the court doesn't have any other questions, we respectfully request that this court reverse Mr. Wearson's convictions or in the alternative, remand for a new trial because of the violation of his right to be present when the jury's questions were presented to the court.
Just one quick question on the jurors' questions later on. My experience always was as a trial court judge that the attorneys, if the court didn't, would, at the end of the trial, when you're kind of going over to make sure all the exhibits are going to get back to the jury and all that sort of thing, would address the issue of whether or not there are questions and what the procedure the court's going to employ as far as contacting them and getting them back and all that sort of thing. Did that not occur at all here?
Nothing. The record is only closing arguments, instructions were read to the jury, we'll break, came back, we have a verdict. That's it. And there was nothing else on the record between closing arguments, instructions, and when the verdict came in. But we found that these questions were part of the record, and the judge actually put them on MGA. So they are part of the record, and the court can consider those.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days. That is the final oral argument on today's calendar. And so the court is now in recess.
All rise.